Chicago. This is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight featuring commentary by James Garrick, Mark Levin, Craig Kepstein, and Khalil Morar. Our program tonight coming to you from our home base at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago, where our toll-free lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to email us a comment, our email address is btb@museum.tv. And if you'd like to join us on the World Wide Web, it's www.beyondthebeltway.com. Tonight, we've got two topics of discussion for you. In hour number two, we're going to be talking about Egypt and our role in that troubled country. But in the first hour, we're going to be talking about a very important speech given this past week by Attorney General Eric Holder. He gave that speech to the American Bar Association. They were meeting in San Francisco, and one of the big news points out of that speech was the Justice Department of the United States will no longer pursue mandatory minimum sentences for certain low-level nonviolent drug offenders. The Attorney General said too many Americans go to too many prisons for far too long and for no truly good law enforcement reason. And citing the fifth decade of the so-called war on drugs, he said we need to ensure that incarceration is used to punish, deter, and rehabilitate, not merely warehouse and forget. And he said that today a vicious cycle of poverty, criminality, and incarceration traps too many Americans and weakens too many communities. He also said many aspects of putting criminal justice system may actually exacerbate these problems rather than alleviate them. And then the call to arms. It's imperative that we maximize our resources by focusing on protecting national security, combating violent crime, fighting against financial fraud, and safeguarding the most vulnerable members of our society. And he directed federal prosecutors they cannot and should not bring every case or charge every defendant who stands accused of violating a federal law. Those are some of the sweeping things that the Attorney General had to say. And joining us now to share their thoughts and opinions are a great group. First of all, let us begin with Mark Levin. Mark joins us from Texas. Mark, nice to have you with us. He is with a group called Right on Crime.
Well, thank you for having me.
Right on Crime is a conservative organization based in Texas. It's the Texas Policy Institute also that you direct. And as a conservative, what was your reaction to Eric Holder's speech?
Well, yes, you're absolutely right. The Texas Public Policy Foundation, we've been a conservative think tank since 1989 and launched Right on Crime in 2010 to have a discussion among conservatives about what criminal justice reforms are needed. And I thought that his speech was really welcome. I think, frankly, the feds are a little late to the party because we've been seeing a lot of reform at the state level that we can discuss, but including under many conservative governors, Governor Deal in Georgia, Governor Kasich in Ohio, Governor Corbett in Pennsylvania, and Governor Perry, our own, in Texas. So, you know, obviously we're more than 5 years into the Obama administration, but, you know, we're certainly pleased that this did occur and that undoubtedly there's some excessive federal prosecutions for very small drug cases.
And we should
where these
We should mention also that the Attorney General did he did throw some bouquets to state government where he said there has been some programs that are working well. James Garrick also joins us. Jim is with Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. He's been a leading opponent against the war on drugs. Jim, what was your reaction to the Attorney General's comments?
Well, I, of course, was very pleased to see that common sense is now beginning to enter the federal courts as well as the state courts. We have for too long put too many people in prison because we've decided to outlaw consensual crime. The consensual, quote-unquote, crime being adults who want to buy and sell drugs, just as once upon a time they wanted to buy and sell liquor. And the United States outlawed liquor, and it was a complete failure, really caused the things we were trying to prevent, including violent crime, created the syndicate, and made life untenable for many people.
But before you go too far and get too enthusiastic, I mean, this this could be construed by some conservatives, and Craig Capstein, you're the closest thing to a card-carrying conservative we have at least in the studio here tonight. What was your reaction to Attorney General Holder, who you have been critical of in the past?
Well, my reaction was simply one thing. I don't think the Attorney General has the right to forget about or to not respond to laws set by the United States Congress and the various states. Of course, the states, that's not federal law. But I don't think he has the right to really say this is what we're going to do and what we're not going to do. And these laws we think we'll follow up on, and those we won't.
But specifically,
he's forgetting
about one issue, and that
is that drugs, the users of drugs, have to have income in order to buy drugs. And I hope they won't forget about the idea of people committing crimes to come up with money to buy drugs.
But in this particular case, correct me if I'm wrong, what the Attorney General was talking about were federal prisoners.
Right, federal prisoners.
Federal prisoners, specifically. Khalil Morar, also of Governor State University, also joins us. He'll be talking a great deal in the second hour, where his expertise is Egypt, but weigh in on the subject, if you will.
Yeah, I mean, the academic debate on this is that, you know, you have one side of the populace and of the political establishment that basically says that we are unduly and unjustly incarcerating people that are nonviolent. The other side that is saying that, you know, selling drugs is a violent event. You know, for example, we have people that overdose on drugs, and that is the epitome of violence. What Eric Holder is trying to do is trying to basically take away the mandatory sentencing proviso, which is something that is welcomed by a lot of people because it would free up our prisons for more violent offenders. But at the same time, we have to be very careful and emphasize that, you know, those that do sell hardcore drugs are perhaps violent offenders because of the outcome of their salesmanship.
Mark, the focus I want to ask with you, because again, I've been introduced, you're a conservative organization, you've been on this program before. To what extent is the economic impact and the inefficiency of the criminal justice system and the Bureau of Prisons, to what extent is that a major rallying cry for your fellow conservatives?
Well, it is. I mean, obviously with Light on Crime, we have people involved like Ed Meese and Bill Bennett, the former drug czar who have signed our statement of principles, Newt Gingrich, and none of us involved with Light on Crime want to legalize hard drugs. But what we do want to do is prioritize correctional resources, and we've seen things like drug courts, for example, that are far more cost-effective than just locking people up who have an addiction. Now, when we're talking about drug dealing, certainly people that are major federal drug kingpins, major international drug kingpins, I think the Attorney General rightly said those people are going to continue to be subject to the toughest sentences. But what we're talking about is now half of the federal prison population is drug offenders, and most of them, as Justice Scalia noted over a year ago, are now nickel and dime, kind of your street corner dealer who's dealing a very small amount of drugs to, you know, people in the neighborhood. And, you know, of course he should be prosecuted by the state and local government, which is how it would have been done decades ago. But this just as the federal government has grown in so many other areas, it has ballooned in this area. And it's a threat to federalism and, you know, the primary role of state and local governments in dealing with criminal justice.
And also those 40% of those federal prisoners, once they get out, they will be back in 3 years later. And it's 60% if you're serving time in a state prison. So recidivism is another issue. We'll talk about that when we come back. 1-800-723-8289. I'm Bruce Dumont. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago, wherever you're listening from coast to coast and border to border tonight. If you have served in prison and you've made it out legally, you've served your time, and you would like to call in and share some of your experiences in getting back into the mainstream, that would certainly be something we'd be interested in hearing your thoughts this evening, because as I said right before the break, the recidivist rate, which means the rate that prisoners go back into prison within 3 years after they get out, 40% of them in the federal system go right back in, and it is 60% in the general population of state prisons. Does your group deal with those issues, Mark? And if so, what is the significant impediment to one's success once they have served their time?
Oh, well, absolutely. I mean, And that's the unfortunate part about this, particularly at the state level, when you have people going in for sometimes 8 months or a year for, you know, a small amount of drugs, like less than a gram of drugs, for example, in Texas, that you go to state jail for an average of 8 months. You come out, very difficult to get a job, obviously, very difficult to get housing. Your ties have often been severed with family, friends, churches, and other sources of support. So the advantage, of course, of having somebody in probation or treatment or drug court or something like that is that they can kick their habit but maintain their job, support their family, pay child support. Obviously, if they stole something to get money for drugs, pay restitution to whoever they stole it from. But none of that happens when you're in prison. And the problem is you meet a bunch of really hardened folks, and these addicts come back out. They actually could be dangerous when they weren't when they came in. And that's why a lot of states have really been moving towards alternatives to incarceration for these types of low-level drug offenders.
Craig, during the break, you made some points about those most likely to come back and get into the system again.
Well, typically, those that have been involved with drugs, not as dealers but as users, really almost form the largest group of people to go back into prisons in recidivism. And the reason why is they often can't learn to trust anybody. The issue of trust is lost, even with heavy counseling sometimes. And again, what our speaker there, what Mark just said, family breakups, the cessation of families accepting people and marriage situations that break up also, they have a terrible way of taking that person almost on the road instantly back to drugs.
Jim? And the criminal justice system is what is breaking up families, incarcerating people in such huge numbers. Because of the war on drugs and our zero tolerance of the war of drugs and drug use, we have multiplied the federal prison system tenfold. We have gone from a country with about 300,000 people behind bars to a country of 2.3 million people. Behind bars. The United States has 5% of the world's population and 25% of the world's prison population. It is the war on drugs that has displaced our priorities.
Jim, let me again, the statistics are staggering. But I want to add, this program deals with process and it deals with politics. And that's why I want to focus on it at the moment. I mean, the fact that our prisons are filled right now is because we've had a generation or two of the public and politicians who three strikes and you're out, throw away, lock up the key. Basically what Eric Holder was saying the other day is that the era of one size fits all is over, that the idea that three strikes and you're out and you're in prison or you're going to have heavy sentencing for a first-time offender, he's suggesting that those days are over and they should be numbered. Is that the way you see it, Mark? Because I want to get back to the uniqueness of what you're doing, and Eric Holder even referenced it. If you know, we hear so much about that Washington doesn't work and this partisan split in the country. This is an issue that is brought together bipartisan support. Patrick Leahy,
absolutely.
Mike Lee.
There's bills in Congress sponsored by Rand Paul and Mike Lee, two conservative senators, that would go for even further than the attorney general did. And so I think with the conservative states that have enacted reforms, with obviously us being out there with Right on Crime, having so many conservative leaders signing on board with us, that does kind of fertilize the soil, so to speak, so that this type of decision can be made without. Because if you look at, there's been a little criticism of it from the right, but it's really all been about whether he has the authority to do it, which frankly he does, because this isn't like the Obama administration waiving, parts of Obamacare and delaying parts, which is, in many ways arbitrary and outside the power of the executive branch. But this is talking about prosecutorial discretion. Every day prosecutors exercise discretion about whether to charge a person with a crime, and if so, what level of offense to use. There are over 4,500 federal crimes. There's a law professor that wrote a book, Three Felonies a Day, Harvey Silverglate, that we all, there's 11 felonies in Texas just on harvesting oysters. So prosecutors could spend all day charging virtually anybody they want for anything, but they, of course, need to prioritize limited correctional resources and focus on public safety. And that's, they have the authority to decide who to charge with what. And it's, and so I think that while definitely Congress would be much better to have more durable reform to these mandatory minimum statutes so we don't depend on the edict of who the next attorney general may be, I do think Holder was within his authority in this area anyway.
Is it your belief that these directives can take place immediately? And does it affect the current population of federal prisons? Because one of the things that Eric Holder spoke about was compassionate release of the elderly. And there's a fairly large number of people who are either incapacitated because of age or infirmity that sit in federal prisons. And in many cases, I know some cases where they may be, you know, 70 plus years old and they may have, you know, another, you know, 20 years to go on a sentence. It doesn't make any sense, it seems to me, for those folks to continue to be, in the federal prisons. I mean, can he release those people or direct the Bureau of Prisons to release them next week, Mark, in your view?
Well, there is some authority that the Federal Bureau of Prisons has to release people to home supervision that they have not been fully taking advantage of. And so there is existing statutory authority that the Bureau of Prisons has not been fully utilizing. Now, not everybody there obviously would be eligible for that. You have to have served vast majority [S2] Right. [S1] Of your sentence and so forth. But it has been troubling that up to date, the Bureau of Prisons hasn't taken full advantage of what the limited statutory framework, the flexibility that they have, which they should have more.
But are they, again, just for clarification here, is the Bureau of Prisons, which I have been told is one of the most powerful agencies of the government because of their lobbying expertise, are they under the direction of the Attorney General?
Yes, they're part of the Department of Justice. Absolutely.
That's
In fact,
what I thought.
They're now over a quarter of the Department of Justice budget. So every federal prosecutor works under Eric Holder. So you're absolutely right. That was part of his directive, and I believe all of these directives are effective immediately. It'll, of course, be up to now prosecutor would if somebody there may be certain things that a judge would have to sign off on, but you know, hopefully we'll see some real fruit born from this announcement, but there's still, you know, laws on the books that need to be changed, and there are a lot of good bills pending in Congress, and you're absolutely right. This is just about the only thing that I think there's bipartisan support on these days.
Craig Kepstein.
I need to say that I'm pretty impressed by the Holder idea. He's come out with a very good idea this time, but the listener should know that a very small part of the prison population is really sentenced by the federal government. Most of the sentences for drug use or drug running, what have you, are state crimes.
Right. But again, what Holder's talking about, that's why I think it's very important that we do that, is that we are talking about within his jurisdiction. That's the federal realm.
May I interject?
Yes.
That's the second time that he's made some comment about the percent of who's in prison. The federal prison system, over 60% of the people there are there for drug offenses. And the state system is more like 23 or 25%. So it's an overwhelming number of people who are in the federal penitentiary system because of drugs. I'm holding a graph, which I wish we could show on TV, but it's showing that the violent crime has remained constant from 1998 through the present time. Property crime, no change. The increases are humongously in the incarceration of nonviolent drug offenders, because we have a zero tolerance policy for drugs in this country, which has proliferated and put drugs everywhere, because drug policy ironically works in reverse. The harder you try to suppress it, the worse the problem becomes. The more anti-drug advertising you do, the more drug use you have. The more you outlaw them and increase the penalties, the more the value of the drug increases, increasing drug use everywhere. In Michigan, where I just was last week, they have the household survey for 2004 said 9% of the people over the age of 14 in the state of Michigan used illicit drugs within the last month. You can't lock up 9% of the state of Michigan. They're spending $2 billion a year on the prison system in the state of Michigan. It's one of the four states in the United States that spends more on prisons than they do on higher education. and they're cutting 15% out of the higher education budget in order to lock up more people. Wow. In Texas, where Mark is from, they were running like 170,000 people behind bars. Illinois were 50,000. California, 170,000. So bad that the United States Supreme Court has said let 30,000 people out from the state of California. Eric Holder was correct when he said we need to virtually not charge the crimes that Congress have enacted and made and applied mandatory minimum sentences to them. He says we need to start releasing geriatric prisoners that are no longer any harm to anyone. The politicians already collected the votes to get tough, crack down three-time loser laws, lock them up, throw away the key, which is what the war on drugs was. And now people are going back to prison for technical violations because they're using marijuana while they're on probation or parole, just cluttering the prison system and preventing violent crime from being prosecuted.
We've got to pause. 1-800-YOU-SAID-A-LOT. 1-800-723-8029. I want to let you weigh in wherever you're listening from coast to coast and border to border. I'm Bruce Dumont, live every Sunday night from Chicago. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thank you very much for joining us around the table this evening. We have Mark Levin. He is the director of the Center for Effective Justice, Texas Public Policy Foundation, and the policy director for Right on Crime. He joins us from his home in Texas this evening. Also around the table, James Gerrick is here. Jim, give us 30 seconds on who you are and why you're here.
I'm a former prosecutor in Cook County. I helped write Illinois' Constitution. I've been in private practice representing cities, villages, and townships for some 40 years. I started out the most vigorous prosecutor you could find, particularly of drug crime, and now I'm absolutely opposed to the war on drugs because it causes what it was designed to prevent, because it is the heart of nearly any crisis you can name in America.
Craig Kepstein also joins us. Craig, give us your credentials for this particular discussion. In the next hour, we're going to be talking about your military background, but you have some expertise in incarceration in the criminal justice system.
I spent 4 years on the Governor's Advisory Board in Adult Division Corrections
in
the state of Illinois. Hired 51 ex-inmates in a program that lasted over 10 years, with only six of them leaving the program. Unfortunately, at the time, all six were drug abusers. I was on the I received the John Howard Award in Corrections and also was on the Pace Institute Board of Directors in Cook County, and that's enough said.
Khalil Marar also joins us from Northeastern Illinois University. Give us a little bit about your background.
Yeah, Governor State University.
My
background is I'm a social scientist who has been studying American government and international affairs for about 10 years. I study institutions like the Bureau of Prisons, and I study the nexus between state and local politics, specifically the kind of stuff that's taking place with Holder talking about mandatory sentencing.
And by the way, in case you just tuned in, we're talking about the Attorney General's speech to the American Bar Association last week, in which the Justice Department will no longer pursue mandatory minimum sentences for certain low-level nonviolent drug offenders. That it's the pushing of those charges that have led to the overpopulation of prisons in the United States at the state and federal level. The U.S. prison population now is more than 2.4 million people. That's more than quadrupled since 1980. That means more than one out of every 100 American adults is behind bars. 14% of the prison population is in federal prisons, and that is the group we are talking about this evening, because as the Attorney General, he directs the federal prisons, not the state prisons. The single largest driver in the increase in the federal prison population since 1998 is longer sentence for drug offenders. The average inmate in minimum security federal prisons costs $21,000 a year each. The average inmate in maximum security federal prisons is $33,000 each a year. Federal prison costs are expected to rise 30% and be 30% of the Department of Justice's budget by 2020. Now, on the bipartisan level, Democratic Senators Dick Durbin of Illinois, Patrick Leahy of Vermont, Mike Lee, Republican of Utah, and Rand Paul, Republican of Kentucky, have all endorsed legislation to give federal judges more flexibility when sentencing nonviolent offenders. And Holder backs this bill. Currently, a federal judge has to abide by the congressional passed law, which mandates, regardless of what the evidence suggests, it mandates that someone spends a minimum of 5 years in prison if they're found guilty of even minor drug offenses or cases of child pornography and things of that nature. The most serious charge against 51% of those inmates is a drug offense. Only 4% are for robbery and 1% are for homicide. The most serious charge against 20% of state prison inmates is drug offense. That's much lower than the 51% in federal prisons. And at least 17 states are currently experimenting with some of the reforms that Eric Holder spoke about. And Mark Levin joins us. He is with Right on Crime. Tell us about some of the states, because, again, when you were first on this program about 8 or 9 months ago, I think you opened a lot of eyes, because the popular perception of the state of Texas is that that is the poster child, the poster state for lock them up and throw away the key. And yet you made your very strong case that some of the most significant reforms in the country are happening in the state of Texas.
Well, that's right. I mean, and we're actually seeing our prison population, our incarceration rate is down more than 10% just over the last several years. And the crime rate in Texas has also fallen more than 10% during that time. And so the main focus in Texas was actually budgetary. One of the reasons state prison populations had grown over the years is that all the money went into expanding prisons and virtually no money went into expanding drug courts, expanding access to treatment, improving the probation system so you have manageable caseloads. And a lot of what we saw was judges and prosecutors were in states like Texas, where they do have a lot of discretion, sending people to prison simply because the alternatives weren't available. So we remedied that. And we are seeing in a lot of states like Georgia, for example, and Pennsylvania, South Carolina, Kentucky, a number of states have adopted changes to say that people who are caught with a very small amount of drugs just for possession would not be sent to prison, or there would be at least a presumption that they would not be sent to prison unless a judge determines they're a danger to public safety, to make some findings to that effect. So that that's really, I think, what we're seeing is states saying we have to distinguish between people we're mad at and those we're actually afraid of.
The focus of this speech was were violations of federal drug laws. But when you look at the federal prison system, and again, we're talking specifically about the prison system, and we're talking about the direction of the attorney general to say to U.S. attorneys, you have got to decide which federal cases get prosecuted, or which violations get prosecuted in federal courts and which ones get prosecuted in state courts. One of the other fast-growing crimes is internet pornography, in many cases involving children. Is that the next logical place where this discussion should go? Because isn't there also maybe some improper violation, or at least not smart common sense thinking that's going into the prosecution of that crime? And how does one decide which case gets prosecuted in the state and which case gets prosecuted federally? Because in many cases, you can go to prison in a federal prison for having watched child pornography, and yet if you were prosecuted in the state system for being a molester, you would get less time.
Well, yeah, that's an interesting issue. You know, and one of the issues it also raises is prostitution, because particularly in state and local jails, you find a lot of people there for prostitution. And what we did in Texas was this past legislative session passed some legislation to create prostitution diversion courts, which is based on a pilot program that's been very successful in Dallas, where you're getting these women, and sometimes it's men too, but getting them into treatment and creating a way for them to get out of it while still holding them accountable. And frankly, one of the things is a lot of the prostitutes are actually victims of human trafficking. Yeah. And in fact, there was a proposal, unfortunately it didn't go through, but to say those who were victims of human trafficking would be able to get their record expunged, which I think is certainly worth looking at. So, you know, you're absolutely right that the thing about it is we put judges on the bench and we put juries in the jury box to exercise discretion to make decisions about based on a person's whether they have a prior record, what their risk level is, whether they've expressed remorse for what they did, based on all these factors to come up with a just sentence, a sentence that fits the crime. And mandatory minimums, you know, while it's somewhat hard to argue against them for things like murder and rape, perhaps, but when you start to apply them to nonviolent offenses of all kinds, you can end up with injustice because there's different facts in every case. And essentially what mandatory minimums involve is substituting the judgment of politicians, of members of Congress, for people, whether it's the judge or jury, who actually have the facts of the specific case in front of them.
Jim Garrick, you were shaking your head as I was speaking and as Mark was speaking.
To even bring up the subject of prostitution or pornography when we have people shooting and killing each other across this nation, 60,000 people in Mexico. Last night in Chicago, we had 3 people killed. We had 20-some shot, and we're talking about prostitution. It's absurd. It is the war on drugs and prohibition, which is the monster that is eating up the state and federal budgets of this country. Drugs are a health care.
Eric Holder's talking about that, at least on the federal level. That's what we're. That's why we're doing this.
He is talking about eliminating mandatory minimums for nonviolent drug offenses, which is the monster that's eating us up. The money is going because we are so intolerant of drug use that we are willing to set aside murder, armed robbery, home invasion, all these other things get no attention. Instead, we end up policing for profit so that the police who get half of the money locally when they seize the money, the airplane, the boat, the real estate, and the cash, and half goes to the feds. So
the point that I was making is if Eric Holder is, as he said, and this came out, he described this as goes back years because of his personal relationship with Barack Obama, that they were looking for a plan that is both that has common sense and is pragmatic. And my point is, if you're making the case that the federal prosecutors should have the discretion as to which cases they push and which ones they do not, in hopes that they're not forcing a federal judge into abiding by mandatory minimums, if they're doing that for drugs, which they obviously are, because that's the largest percentage of those in federal prisons, then my point was, why would you not do it for other less violent crimes that like prostitution and some of the other crimes? It seems to me that falls in the line of common sense if you're going to do that.
It's just that one is a pimple on the butt of the world. It's so insignificant, it shouldn't come up.
Well, it did. 1-800-723-8229 from coast to coast and border to border. If you have questions, give us a call. We have those left of center and we have those right of center. And tonight, for the most part, they're agreeing. 1-800-723-8229. I'm Bruce Dumont from Chicago. Back in Chicago. Thanks very much for joining us. Mark Levin, let me also ask you one piece of this discussion that we haven't spoken too much about, and that is the federal judges. Now, as I understand it, the federal judges feel a little uncomfortable with the mandatory minimum sentence laws that Congress has given to them as well. Is that correct?
Well, yeah, it ties the hands of judges, and so you've seen, I mean, Justice Rehnquist, the late Chief Justice, very conservative jurist, was very critical of mandatory minimums, particularly as it relates to nonviolent offenses, because it left judges with no ability to kind of craft the sentence based on the specific facts of the case, whether, you know, someone had a long prior record and a record of violent crime, for example, and was now there for a drug offense versus somebody who didn't have that. And so I think that this will be welcomed by judges, but again, we still should change the actual statute, so we're not just dependent
That's what I want to get to, because at this particular moment, again, if you have federal judges that don't like the idea of mandatory minimums, we now know that the Attorney General doesn't like the idea of mandatory minimums. He sent a directive out to all of his U.S. attorneys to dissuade them from pushing for mandatory minimums. So I guess my next question would be from a legislative standpoint, and you swim in the legislative waters not only locally in Texas but around the country. What are the next legislative things that need to be done to right some of the wrongs that still exist in the federal prison system?
Well, I think that there are a number of things. I mean, first of all, obviously, the legislation you referred to earlier, bipartisan in Congress, to actually roll back these mandatory minimums for nonviolent offenses. There's also some other legislation that's very good that would deal with things like creating earned time. So certain offenders could earn time both when they're incarcerated and on probation by completing exemplary by behaving in an exemplary
manner.
Is
that the Barber Amendment? Are you familiar with the name of that?
Yeah, that I think that is that does relate to
the Barber. Barber Amendment basically looks at those incarcerated in federal prisons and says, because there is no probation in federal prison, most people don't know that, you can serve up to 85% of your time. You must serve up to 85% of your sentence. Is that correct?
That is indeed right, and then they can release you onto home supervision, but they haven't been fully taking advantage of that.
Right, but what the Barber Amendment is, it reduces serving 85% of your time to 65% of your time for nonviolent offenders. And what that does, it releases people from prison earlier. It sends them to halfway houses or to ankle bracelets. And Jim, again, I know that you want to eliminate all drug laws, in essence. But I mean, would you, again, because we live in an incremental society, I mean, would you say that things like that are a huge step in the right direction to erasing this lock 'em up one size fits all era that Eric Holder allegedly wants to get rid of?
Yes, it's a step in the right direction. The most important thing we need to do is to reprioritize violent crime over and above drug crime. We need to be spending less money, less resources on prohibition. We need to restore federal judges with discretion to be able to decide what should be done in a particular case.
But you don't think we should spend – wait, let me just jump in here. You don't think we should spend less money on diversionary programs, on programs if someone is being released from prison and they do have a drug problem, they either had it, that to have in community drug programs, drug treatment programs, you don't oppose that, do you?
They're not
just going to stop willy-nilly.
I am opposed to this drug testing of people when they come out and they have some minor violation of alcohol or of marijuana, and we send them back to prison, I think that's wrong. I would like to see it stopped. I want to spend less money to find that violation.
And do you want to spend more money in that area? Do you think it's a wiser investment? Again, or in your view, Mark, are we just shifting the cost of running our federal prisons to the cost of setting up treatment programs for those who do get out so they don't go back again? Is it the same amount of money just diverted in a different direction?
Well, the great news is any alternatives cost far less, I mean, than prison. I mean, a probation in Texas, it's $1.70 a day for taxpayers, and prison is $50 a day. So, but I will also agree that to some extent by saying that when people do test positive for drugs or have an alcohol issue or whatever while they're on probation, it doesn't mean they should necessarily go back to prison for 10 years or whatever's left on their sentence. There's a lot of research now on graduated sanctions. You can use things, whether it's a curfew or electronic monitoring to make sure somebody's going to treatment, and you can extend their term of probation. There's a lot of things you can do short of sending them back to prison for a long time, because we know everyone who recovers from drugs, or most everyone, has some type of relapse on the way when they're recovering from an addiction.
What quality does someone get as far as treatment when they're in prison? While they're in prison serving their time at the federal prisons at the moment, because the recidivist rate is at 40%, are they getting any treatment at all while they're under the house and care of the Bureau of Prisons?
Well, it's quite limited. I mean, the problem is the federal prisons were really built for people like international drug pins, Bernie Madoff, so they weren't really designed with the idea of treating people with an addiction, because historically those people would have been at the state level. And, of course, obviously states have varying levels of availability of treatment, but typically there are some programs, but often you have large waiting lists to get into them. And then the other problem is, for things like mental health, you know, a prison setting isn't the best setting for treating people with mental
Mark
health.
Mark Levin,
issues.
We are running out of time. Give us your email address if somebody wants to contact you.
Great. Well, the website's rightoncrime.com, and I'm at mlevin, M-L-E-V-I-N, at texaspolicy.com.
All right. That's Mark Levin. He will not be with us for the next hour, but again, the next time you're in Chicago, do stop by. We'd like to continue this discussion. It appears that this is one of those issues that Republicans and Democrats can maybe come together on, and that a serious issue of criminal justice in the United States can be addressed. It's something that actually can get better. Let's hope so. In the next hour, we're going to be talking about Egypt. Who knows whether that can get better? Probably not quickly. Back shortly from Chicago. Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont. We continue with hour number two of Beyond the Beltway. Tonight featuring commentary by James Garrick, Craig Capstein, and Khalil Morar. In this hour of our program, phone lines remain open at 1-800-723-8289. We switch gears from our discussion of Eric Holder's mandatory minimum speech to the American Bar Association last week, and we're going to be talking about Egypt, the other big national, international story of the day. Egyptian authorities raided homes this afternoon of the Muslim Brotherhood members in an apparent attempt to disrupt the group ahead of mass rallies by supporters of the country's ousted president. Under the banner of an anti-coup alliance, the Brotherhood said it will hold a demonstration in southern Cairo, later today. Rallies are also planned across the country by supporters of ousted President Mohamed Morsi, who was deposed in a coup on July 3rd. Over 850 people have been killed nationwide since Wednesday's dismantling of two encampments of Morsi supporters in Cairo, and that was an act that sparked fierce clashes. Again, it has embarrassed the world. It has embarrassed them. It has embarrassed the United States to some extent. And Khalil Morar joins us. His area of expertise is international relations from Governor State University, born in Kuwait, an American citizen now. You were on this program last week. You were warning us of things getting worse there, and they certainly have gotten worse.
Absolutely, they've gotten worse, and there's two reasons why they got worse. The first is this is really a death spiral, and it involves the Muslim Brotherhood on the one hand and the Egyptian military on the other hand. I mean, these are two very prominent institutions within Egyptian society that are not going to go away conveniently anytime soon, and it's perceived now that any gain of the Muslim Brotherhood is the loss of the military, and vice versa. Any gain in the military is the loss of the Muslim Brotherhood. But we have to sort of pull back, especially as Americans sitting in this room. We're sort of, you know, far away from the violence, and we have to ask ourselves what took place in Egypt. And what did take place in Egypt is that you have a democratically elected government that was overthrown, that was toppled by the military. You had a coup d'etat. No matter what the Obama administration has said or has refused to said, and more aptly has refused to said about the situation, we basically have a situation in which you had a military that took over power from a civilian command. Now, granted, the civilian command was the Muslim Brotherhood. Granted, I personally disagree with the Islamists throughout the Middle East. But at the same time, the Muslim Brotherhood was never really given the chance to govern. 1 year is not nearly enough time to govern the country of 80 million people.
Craig Capstein also joins us. He's a retired captain in the U.S. Navy. He's a Middle East analyst of long standing. He's been to 113 countries. Also was on Norman Schwarzkopf's staff during the Gulf War. Your reaction of what is happening in Egypt, because you are very concerned.
I would call it a coup also, but I think you have an interesting dynamic in Egypt that you don't very often see. This isn't just the military, Khalil. This is the military and the Islamic Brotherhood, but there's a dynamic that is a growing element of Egyptians that belong to neither. that have said, we're sick and tired of this. We don't want this. You've stolen our country. You've focused the last year on trying to bring in Sharia law. What are you doing to our women? What are you doing to our economy? The economy is in tatters. Egypt gets a huge part of its GNP from tourism, which has literally died in the country.
Yeah.
When tourism dies, the economy dies. When the economy dies, the country goes to hell, which is going on.
Let's go to Paul, listening to us in Tampa, Florida, first caller tonight. Go ahead, listening on the Internet. Go ahead, Paul.
Great show, Bruce.
Thank you.
Just wanted to briefly say that the Obama administration, with less than 35% approval rating, has not only been feckless in the U.S. policy, but look how Obama has angered both sides. Actually, if you consider the Christians that are being slaughtered, there are more people that are being persecuted as a result of Obama's mishandling of his foreign policy. Can anyone on your panel defend Obama's handling of the foreign policy?
I'm going to ask the professor what grade he would give them.
I would give the Obama administration a D-minus to possibly an F-plus, if there is such a thing as an F-plus. This, you're right, Paul. This has been mishandled. And Christians in the country have been persecuted, according to the numbers. I mean, according to the Coptic Church of Egypt, and the Copts make up about
10%. 100,000 have left within the past year.
Correct. You have a significant amount of Copts that have left Egypt, and they've been sort of like trickling out, for the past three decades for a variety of reasons. But you also have 100 Copts that are dead. Now, granted, you have, a lot more Muslims that have been killed by this regime. But the truth is, you have a situation in which you have a great deal of intolerance in Egyptian society. So it's not just, the Muslim Brotherhood being intolerant towards, say, the rights of minorities and women and so on. It is also a fact that you have intolerance by the military in terms of opposing points of view. They will not allow opposing points of view to be expressed. And, 2 points on this one. Anybody who was watching, any of the news programs yesterday saw that the military was killing, behind armored personnel carriers, was killing unarmed civilians. This is what we call a crime against humanity, and somebody has to be brought to justice, especially the leader of Egypt, the General Assisi. The second thing that we have to consider is that—
What should President Obama say?
Two things. The president should say that, you're walking on a very thin line at this time, and that—
Which he's done.
Our support for you, and this is something that he has not done. The $1.3 to $1.5 billion in aid is in jeopardy. This is something that has to be expressed very clearly by the Obama administration. And the Egyptians have to know that there are consequences
to their actions. He has to use the word that you both used tonight. He has to say coup.
Yeah.
Because if there is a military coup, it is the law that U.S. Support for Egypt is supposed to be pulled.
Absolutely.
And everyone's calling it a coup.
Absolutely.
Except him.
He can't call
it
a coup.
That's to give himself wiggle room in the Middle East. Egypt is our largest client in the Middle East.
They are. And look, I mean, he can't
client
call it
for what? Our money.
No.
Flying for our money.
For
our
stabilization
support
of the Middle East. As Egypt goes, much of the Middle East could go.
And that is true. I mean, and we have to remember that, a fundamental part of the Egyptian-Israeli peace treaty in the 1970s,
absolutely,
Camp David Accords, is that aid that the United States gives to Egypt and, by the way, gives to Israel, right? So the two are interconnected. Now, here's the thing. If the Obama administration comes out and calls us a coup, you're right. Their hands are tied and they have to cancel the aid. The problem with that, however, is that canceling the aid with Egypt or to Egypt has dire consequences for the United States, much more so than Egypt. Egypt has $12 billion, with a B, dollars lined up from the Gulf states. They really don't care right now about the paltry $1.5 billion that we give them. So the United States has much more invested in making sure that Egypt may
run that by us again. They have how much? They have $12 billion standing by.
Correct. From the Gulf states.
From the other Gulf states.
From the Arab Gulf states. Because the Arab Gulf states.
The military regime now.
Correct. Okay. And so
because they want to stamp out the Muslim Brotherhood too.
That's right. Saudi Arabia does not like the moderate Muslim vision that the Muslim Brotherhood has, and they want
to crush
it.
It's not a moderate vision.
And it is a moderate vision. Now, look.
With Al-Qaeda.
Listen to me very carefully. I don't support the Muslim Brotherhood. I want to go on the record saying this. But at the same time, we have to recognize the fact that one of their first acts after they took power is the protection of Coptic churches.
But that this doesn't protect women in the country.
But look, we have to be cognizant of the fact that you're right. The more extreme Muslim variations do not protect women. But at the same time, the Muslim Brotherhood is not Al-Qaeda. We
have
to point
that out.
Think
about the past week. They burned 40 Christian churches.
They did.
And destroyed 23 others.
They who? They not the Muslim Brotherhood. They don't condone that. They, the protesters, who are lawless right now. And that's something we have to bring in.
When we come back, I want to talk about our $1 billion a year that we send over there. At the moment, we've just heard Khalil say they don't really need it. Well, then they don't really need it. Should we pull it? And if so, what's the spiral? What happens next?
The consequence.
From Austin, Texas to Sacramento, California, you are listening to Beyond the Beltway on America's great talk radio stations, as well as Sirius and XM satellite radio. And, Craig, you were going to make a point during the break when I had asked the question about what happens if we pull that $1 billion a year. We heard Khalil say that they've got a nice stockpile of money from the other Arab nations. Would they even miss the $1 billion right now? And what signal would it send?
If they didn't miss the $1 billion, they might miss all of the equipment, the military equipment we've given them. How are they ever going to get that?
It's being used against the people and shooting them down?
Yes, it is.
The tanks,
but
was
remember
American
what
tanks?
Happened with a predecessor when he had all the Russian equipment, all the Russian planes, ships, and everything else. When Russia pulled out, all that stuff sat in a field and it went to seed. But the key that would happen is that you take a look at the situation with Israel and with Egypt and Israel and the Palestinians in Israel and the rest of the Middle East. That's the first thing that would take a hit. The second thing is...
In what way? What would happen?
Will the peace treaty stay in place? Will a broader war break out?
That's the key question right now. No, you're absolutely right about that. I mean, a cornerstone of the Camp David Accords is that aid to Egypt. So you're absolutely right about that. We can't be jeopardizing it, especially right now as we're talking to the Palestinians and the Israelis about peace. So no one in their right mind would advocate a cutting off of the aid right now.
United States, Kelly Ayotte did it on TV today. John McCain has done it. Lindsey Graham has done it.
They're not.
The list of people who have said
those people are
cut
crazy.
Off aid. John McCain is crazy.
He's crazy about on this one, right? And the reason he's crazy, maybe crazy like a fox on this one, right? But he's crazy on this one insofar as I can't even imagine the dire consequences that would happen in the region as a result of us cutting off aid, right?
Absolutely. None of the other countries would ever trust us again.
And they wouldn't.
And McCain is out of his mind. I agree totally.
Because we turn our back on our allies, right? I'm not advocating on the record. I'm not advocating cutting off aid. What I'm doing, however, what I'm insisting upon is that we have to say that there are carrots and there are sticks. And one of the biggest sticks that we have is the cutting off of that aid. I'm not advocating that we cut off aid. All I'm saying is that it has to be on the table if the Egyptian military does not return to democracy immediately and stop killing civilians in the streets of Cairo.
Why? Why would they do it? Because you've just described, you've got the military.
Yeah.
The military is there, as you say, they've got $12 billion from the other Arab states.
Correct.
Okay?
Yeah.
As you've just explained, the United States is speaking softly and not doing much, and they're not really talking about pulling their $1 billion
That's right.
out. Okay.
That's right.
So they're sitting there now they do have this problem called people in the streets.
Yeah. Huge.
And yet some of the people in the streets that are being murdered, 800 over 850
yeah.
last
yeah, almost
week.
Almost 1,000 now.
That's
yeah.
a lot of people to be murdered.
That's
but
right.
But it's also a huge country.
It is
so there's
country.
A lot of people that are in the, there are a lot of people in their homes that they're saying, you know what? Hey, 850 people were killed. You know what? That's a small number. You know what? I want the military to keep doing what they're doing.
A lot of Egyptians also have said.
Is that a large number?
That is a large number. I mean,
are we talking 50-50 here? Looking at a country that is absolutely running down the road to a civil war, Craig?
It's possible it could run down to a civil war, but look at also the military really was reasonable until they started finding their own members getting shot.
The protesters.
Over 100 of the military died.
Yeah.
Probably 100 now of the police have died.
Police, right.
You can't take them as target practices and expect that they're going to stand there and do nothing.
The overwhelming.
So we as Americans, we should not think that the influence of the Muslim Brotherhood is growing. We should view it as a small group, not a small,
it's
a significant
it's a large group.
A significant group of Egyptians hate their military dictators.
They do.
Just as they hated
the Muslim Brotherhood.
They hate them both.
Yeah, what exactly. And what these protesters have traded is the Muslim Brotherhood, which was, in their eyes, authoritarian for the military regime. I mean, this is – I don't want to go so far as to say this is a fascist regime, but it's bordering on fascism, the way that they are treating their people in the streets. This is not right.
A lot of the people in the Brotherhood hate everything. They hate their government. They hate the economy. They hate non-Muslims.
Educated.
What?
They hate women being educated.
They certainly
do. That's not true. It depends on which brotherhood
you're
talking about.
Jim Garrick also joins us.
All right. This certainly is not my area of expertise, but when I listen to the conversation going on, the comments are that really Obama can't be pulling this aid without making these Arab nations angry, particularly with negotiations going on over the issue affecting Israel. And yet Obama, President of the United States, recognized that we had a new democracy in place for the first time of 1 year in age.
Absolutely.
And so what is the action of the president? He says, well, we were going to have joint military maneuvers with Egypt that we are now not going to do.
That's right.
And everyone knows the money issue is always in the back, is something yet to be done. But as a practical matter, if you're president of the United States, other than talking a little bit, what more, as an effective president, can you do to earn your F+?
Okay, so what more can you do in order to overcome the F+, in order to get a better grade, in my eyes, right?
Please.
Three things, right? First and foremost, we should put the aid, the $1.5 billion, $1.3 to $1.5 billion, on the table. We should not keep it off the table. And I think Senator McCain is absolutely correct in that regard. Maybe crazy like a fox is a better statement, because maybe he believes in threatening Egypt so that they stop off the brink, so they get off the brink. So first thing is, you know, question the aid. Put it on the table. The second thing is call on Egypt's military government to come back from the authoritarian dictatorship that it has committed itself to right now. And the third thing is stop killing protesters on the streets. They didn't have to go in and storm these camps in Rabaa Mosque. They didn't have to go in and storm these peaceful camps elsewhere where there are children and women. I mean, you want to talk about like abusing women's rights? Talk about shooting women in the street. Talk about shooting their husbands and their children in the street. That's the abusing of women's rights. Telling women to veil by some Islamist brotherhood is not as bad as killing women in the streets as the military has committed itself to in the past few days.
Well, the third point, put the money issue on the table. Maybe you're going to lose $1.3 billion.
Yeah,
Obama could say or do that.
Absolutely.
But how does Obama prevent the violence in the streets? How does he say or am we going to land helicopters?
He works behind the scenes.
By telling the Egyptian government to stop using American arms, American-supplied arms to kill civilians.
Isn't he and aren't John Kerry, aren't they already doing that? I mean, most people know that with all of this, with this billions upon, it isn't just 1 billion, it's billion every year.
Yeah.
The second largest recipient of foreign aid is Egypt, next
to
Israel.
That's right.
Virtually every leader, military leader in Egypt was trained by Americans, sometimes on American soil.
The officers
is
on
that
American
correct?
Soil, that's right.
That's absolutely the case. And what Khalil probably didn't quite get to was the fact that the whole Middle East is a fabric that more or less is like an erector set puzzle. If you pull out one piece, the entire place begins to fall apart. Remember, another country over there looking for massive influence in Egypt is Iran.
Yeah.
Only that, but you have a situation where Iran is destabilizing Syria.
Mike in Spokane wants to weigh in on that. Mike is listening to us on KXLY. Mike, you wanted to talk about Iran, did you not?
I did, Bruce. Thank you for taking my call. Where is Iran in all this turmoil in Egypt? What are they up to in Egypt? And secondly, is Iran still building a nuclear weapon?
Craig.
I would say Iran probably is with the Muslim Brotherhood.
No, they're not.
Probably going to work behind the scenes. I would think so.
No, they're not.
Well, they certainly aren't going to be with the military.
You give your opinion,
okay.
And then Khalil will give his.
That's
Craig,
fine.
You give your opinion.
I think that they probably are working behind the scenes to offer some aid and condolences and what have you to the Muslim Brotherhood, who will look for help from disparate sources around the region.
The more we push on the Muslim Brotherhood, the more we will push them into Iran's arms, because they need somebody in the region to speak up on their behalf. This is the problem right now, is that, you know, the Muslim Brotherhood actually presents a different pole, a different element of Islamist government in the region, and Iran was very scared. Look, in 2009, when Iranian protesters went to the streets and protested in the Green Revolution, the Iranian regime did exactly what the Egyptian regime is doing, except, I would dare say, the Egyptian regime is even worse and more bloodlusting in killing its civilians. At least the Iranians had some restraint. So Iran, looking at what's happening in Egypt right now, probably supports the crackdown on the protesters because they're against the freedom of speech.
Al in Austin, Texas, listening to us on KLBJ. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello, Bruce. Thanks for taking my call.
Thanks for calling.
I think it's clear that what's happening in Egypt is that the population had gotten used to kind of a secular society, and the Muslim Brotherhood wanted to impose Sharia law. I think that, what you know, I don't know if it's going to come to a civil war, but the military in Egypt at this point, I think, is supporting the vast majority of the Egyptian population in opposing the Muslim Brotherhood. I think that President Obama, in trying to restrict aid to the Egyptian government at this point, is a real mistake.
Al, you're making very good points. The one thing I would say is that we have to be careful not to misread the situation in Egypt. What we have right now is perhaps worse than a civil war. We have a slaughter. We have a massacre of civilians in the street. A civil war happens.
Maybe they're not civilians. Maybe they are, from what I understand from the news reports I've read, it was armed encampments with snipers on rooftops.
Of course, the military regime is going to put that out. Every fascist regime says that there were provocateurs, right? The question that we should ask ourselves is, to what extent are these peaceful civilians? Look at the film. Look at the videos. Look at the civilians being hunted down the street. These are not armed people. These are unarmed civilians that are being killed by this fascist regime.
I've seen plenty of AK-47s in the footage shown on TV.
It could be both, right, folks? Would you acknowledge it could be both?
Absolutely.
A little bit of both? Okay, 1-800-723-8029 from coast to coast and border to border, live every Sunday night from Chicago. I'm Bruce Dumont.
The one thing...
Bruce Dumont back in Chicago, joining us around the table. Khalil Morar is here. He is a professor of political science at Governors State University, born in Kuwait, but a citizen of the United States. Also with us this evening is Craig Kepstein. He's a retired captain in the U.S. Navy, Middle East analyst of long standing, and also was on General Schwarzkopf's staff. And also James Garrick joins us. He is with Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. We're going to take calls in just a moment. But, Jim, you've gone through this segment with the first hour of the broadcast. For those who did not hear it, you were talking about your pet topic, which is you oppose the war on drugs. And, again, we have not spoken too much in the last couple of years about the role that Afghanistan and that region of the world plays in the supply of drugs. And I'm wondering, you are opposed to the war on drugs, but you've also said on this program that you don't support drug usage. You think that we're wasting our time. But would Afghanistan or any other country in that region, would they last very long if they didn't promote drug traffic, and certainly Afghanistan?
Well, certainly not Afghanistan. Afghanistan supplies 90% or so of the world's heroin. And we have tens of thousands of military troops in Afghanistan walking through the poppy fields. And if we destroy the poppy fields, we're now destroying the livelihood of some 90% of the people. If instead we had a policy that controlled and regulated heroin so it isn't one of the most valuable commodities on the face of the earth, it would affect whether or not the Afghans themselves chose to plant poppies. And that is the secret and the magic to drug policy reform. Not that drugs are good, but by taking the economics out of the equation, it would affect every layer of production, distribution, transportation, and sale in countries like the United States.
Craig, there was a time in the war in Afghanistan with U.S. involvement. There was a time that the United States could have destroyed many of the poppy fields, if not all of them. Mm-hmm. And the United States chose not to do that.
That was a political decision.
All
and
right.
it was designed
Take us
for-
inside that political decision, and is the easy answer, because if you would have destroyed those fields, there would have been nothing else for them to do.
The easy answer is that if you destroy those poppy fields, you destroy much of the GNP of the country, and you have to have an answer to fill in the blank. You also aren't going to deal with anybody who leads that country, and we don't own Afghanistan. We cannot make that decision. It's something I was going to say about the Middle East. The United States may want to carry a big stick, but it does not make the decisions for individual countries in the Middle East or anywhere else.
But when you are engaging in war, follow me through on
yes.
this. Okay. When you are engaged in war and you have U.S. service people mm-hmm. serving their country, waging war against Afghanistan,
right.
and we were waging war against Afghanistan.
Yes.
Is it not one of the goals to destroy that country and destroy their abilities to do things that on the other side of the equation are creating drugs and maybe making life difficult for those in the United States if you believed in the war on drugs? Now, again,
Okay.
But what I'm saying is it seems to me that we were in a position to absolutely drive Afghanistan out of the drug business, and we didn't do it.
Our goal
for
was
political
not,
reasons.
Okay, our goal was not to go over there and destroy the country, as you mentioned. And also, the very good part about the United States military is they are not thugs, and they do not go out and set national policy. National policy directs what they do, and they have no choice but to follow the
So
the
our politicians let Afghanistan continue to be the largest supplier of heroin in the world.
That's exactly
we
what happened.
That.
Yeah,
and
we,
our Congress
did,
and
yeah.
our Congress did it. Republicans and Democrats, everybody
yes,
did it.
Exactly, well, co-equally
and you have to
liable.
Remember, I mean, there's a handful of terrorists that makes us angry with Afghanistan, but that doesn't mean that we should wage war on the average working man.
No, we
shouldn't. And the family that
That's
lives
right.
there. And even if we
so these get, are even, these are poor working Afghanis, and you know what? We should just let them grow their heroin
by,
and
no, we should
send
we should,
it around the
should,
world
we should,
because we can't because they're not. Going to be a tourist.
We should take away their ability to earn the money by changing and controlling and regulating
right.
drugs instead of outlawing it so they decide not to plant their land with that drug.
Even if we had
eliminated all drugs in Afghanistan, they would have been growing somewhere else.
Khalil.
Yeah, I'm going to withhold my judgment on legalization of poppy and heroin and stuff like that. But I will say this. I will say that the overwhelming majority of farmers that actually grow the poppy in Afghanistan are poor people who really don't see a cut. It's the
right.
distributors and the processors that sure. see the cut, the biggest cut of
They're
the
victims.
Heroin trade. Exactly. They are victims in many ways. And look, we have to give the Afghanis an alternative thing, right? So, for example, tourism right now is a growing sector in Afghani society. It's probably the largest growing sector, whereas the poppy trade is actually stagnating. You know, why not open up more opportunity in the tourism sector, for example, and especially since that is very much related to security. You know, as we pointed out in Egypt, security and tourism go hand in hand. Where one thrives or where terrorism thrives, tourism declines.
If we were to make – I want to get reaction from everyone here.
Yeah.
I'll start with you, Khalil. Because the American people, we have heard about, you know, we've had wars in the Middle East. We can't pick up a paper for the last 30 years without one of the major countries in the Middle East being on the front page of
that's
that
right.
newspaper.
That's right.
If you personally, with your educated background, if you were to make a list of the most significant countries
yeah.
in that region, who would be number one?
Egypt.
Who would be on that list for you?
I would put Egypt at the top.
You agree. Why?
Absolutely.
Why?
Because of its numbers of people, its geographic location, its bellwether and acceptance by other countries throughout the region. It's shown a lot of leadership.
So as Egypt goes, so goes the region.
Absolutely. You have to remember this was at the forefront of the Arab Spring and now at the forefront of the Arab Winter. The Arab Spring died in Cairo a few days ago, and it died with the ousting of the democratically elected president of that country, and now you have a fascist military regime that's shooting people dead in the street.
But I would say your second most important country in all of the Middle East is Israel. quite frankly, Israel could aid so many of the Arab countries if they would open their minds.
I would agree with that. And Israel and the Palestinians, I would put on the same par. And peace between the Israelis and the Palestinians is probably the most important element of American policy and national strategy in the Middle East.
Mark, listening to us in Costa Rica tonight on iHeartRadio. Nice to hear from Costa Rica. Go ahead.
Hey, Bruce. Thanks so much for taking my call. Listen, the Syrians, which was so much in the news a couple of weeks ago because of 70,000 dead,
right?
And now we got the shiny new penny of Egypt with the false Arab Spring. Well, both those countries are running full-fledged towards the Russians because Putin's trying to reconvene or reconvey his power in the region. And it's kind of an interesting turn of events, and frankly, I'm glad to see the U.S. turning a negative ear towards the Muslim Brotherhood, because the Muslim Brotherhood, as far as I'm concerned, sets back the world 300 years.
Mark, stay on the line. Stay on the line for a moment. I want to give you a chance to follow up, but I want to get a reaction from our in-studio guest to your comment that that Syria and Egypt are running towards the Russian. Khalil, do you agree with that?
Okay, so Mark, you have a beautiful country, Costa Rica. Thank you for calling us. The first thing that I would say is that Syria has always been in the pocket of the Russians, right? Yeah. So them running towards the Russians is nothing new. They've always been there. But I'm really much more concerned about Egypt being in the Russian camp at this time. You have to remember that the Russians, Putin especially, is now courting the Egyptians and telling the Egyptian military, look, if these Americans will not do military exercises with you, we will. Frankly, because the Russians are all in favor of people getting cracked down on the streets and civilians dying in the streets.
They love
so,
that stuff.
So look, we have to be very careful. I mean, we have to basically assert ourselves with the Egyptians and make sure that they understand that they are supposed to be in the service of the values of the Arab Spring, which, by the way, are the values of the United States of America, that we hold all men to be created equal, that we think that they're all endowed with
all
life,
women
liberty,
also.
And the pursuit of happiness. All women, absolutely, right? And we have to understand that democracy, I don't care what the Muslim Brotherhood did until the ouster, that democracy is much more preferable to governing the country than the anti-democratic, illiberal military regime that has taken over.
Craig, your response. Are they marching towards the Russians?
I think Mark had a good comment on Syria. Russia certainly wants to keep its naval facilities there, and it wants influence in the region, warm weather port and what have you. It's doing what it's always done in Syria, and it's
Egypt?
Also supplying.
Is
in
Egypt
that
marching
way.
Too?
In Egypt, I don't see them marching as quickly, but they are a good fill-in-the-blank if the United States decides to drop out.
What about the rest of the countries? What about the rest of the countries in the region?
You have a serious situation going on in Lebanon right now. The Syrian war is spilling over there.
It is.
Very badly.
Marching
right.
Towards Russia?
No, not at this stage.
Afghanistan is not marching towards Russia.
No, it is definitely not. The Russians
Iran,
want no part
Iraq.
Of Iraq, very possibly, but Iraq is such a mess right now. The only countries looking to help in Iraq are other smaller Gulf states with lots
Libya.
Of money. Libya is an interesting situation. The question is, where did the 400 surface-to-air missiles go that might have been there at our consulate?
Yeah.
And is that why our ambassador died? And my key question is, why were those that dared support the people in the consulate not get the highest honor that this country could bestow on them for holding off these people who were trying to kill them and everybody else?
I agree they should in Libya and the Benghazi attack. And I would add that, you know, Iraq is another case. You know, we've had more deaths in Iraq now than we've had since the Civil War. We have to be cognizant of that fact. And furthermore, we support an Islamist regime in Iraq. Why not in Egypt?
When we come back, we're going to talk about Saudi Arabia. Back shortly from Chicago. Back in Chicago, thank you very much for joining us wherever you listen to this broadcast each and every Sunday night. I hope you enjoy it as much as we do producing it for you and being with you every Sunday night now in our 32nd year on the air. And Before we go off the air and we get rushed out of time at the end, I do want to talk about Saudi Arabia. But, Khalil, I want to – last week when you were on this program, you sort of projected that things were going to get worse in Egypt. Look into your crystal ball right now.
Yeah.
Give us the scenario of what you think happens and how does this play out
over
the next 6 months.
There's two possibilities. You can completely crush the opposition to such an extent that you're going to have the Muslim Brotherhood on the retreat. But it's not just the Muslim Brotherhood. It's everybody that does not support military governance in Egypt, right? This is really truly a coalition, right? So if you kill enough people, and you have to kill enough people, everybody will begin to think, well, maybe it's not wise for me to protest. It's not doing anything anyway. Besides, most of Egypt is against me anyway, and I'm going to die, and nothing's going to happen, right?
And so there's going to be no more Arab Springs.
There's going to be no more Arab Spring. But yes, we have a return, mark my words, to the Mubarak regime without Mubarak, right? We have a military state in Egypt that basically killed the opposition. That's one
scenario.
And
you think that's where it's going to go?
That's where it's heading now. That's where it's heading now. Now, another possible scenario is that there will be enough pressure placed on Egypt with American leadership that basically forces the military's hand, that tells the military generals that they should go back into the barracks where they belong and allow for a truly democratic re-election, perhaps even a reinstatement of the president of Egypt.
Craig, give me your look into the crystal ball. Take us 6 months down the road as you see it.
I think, interestingly, the military in Egypt does not want to govern. I do not see them or hear them say, we want to be leading this country.
Why are they governing then?
I think they're doing it on an interim basis to return it to civilian control.
I don't believe that for a second.
I definitely believe it.
Yeah.
And I see something that I've not seen in other Arab countries, which is masses of people, huge numbers of people supporting the military. It's unheard of. Now, these aren't Christians. These are Islamists.
Look, let me say something, though. I mean, people in 1933, they voted for Adolf Hitler. You have to remember that the guy was popularly elected. So just because we have popular support for the military does not mean that it is right for the military to govern any more than it was right for Adolf Hitler
just
to govern.
Just because we had popular support for Morsi, does that mean does he really speak for all of the people in the country?
He does not. But giving a guy 1 year to govern is unjust and unfair. Allow him to fail.
What did Morsi do that turned
two things
people against him?
He did two things. First, he did nothing about the economy. His platform was much more social. And in that regard, I condemn Morsi. I condemned him way before anybody was condemning him. The second thing that he did is he tried to clip the military's wing and subjugate the military to a civilian chain of command, which is a prerequisite to democracy. You can't have democracy when the military runs the show. And that is precisely why Morsi was trying to subjugate Assisi and the military generals to a civilian chain of command. You, of all people, know about that civilian chain of command.
So let me ask you this. Would you agree with the assessment that Khalil just made? That those were the two big mistakes
I would say
he made?
The third big thing is he brought in Sharia law, which was
that
the
true.
Country was absolutely not ready for Sharia law.
Okay.
Period.
All right. It seems to me that what we have here with Morsi is we have a real bad politician.
Absolutely.
He's good and bad, right? Like most politicians, he's good and bad. He's bad insofar
as
–
Where was he good? Because everything you said so far was bad.
Yeah, so he's good insofar as he got elected by 52% of the Egyptian people. I mean, that's power, man. That's power, right?
He didn't show leadership in the region.
He was bad exactly in that.
Getting elected is one thing.
He was bad in exactly that, is that he didn't
show – Misreading his mandate?
He misread his mandate first and foremost, the Egyptian economy, returning tourism and stuff like that, and really not trying to Islamicize the state and not really worrying about a social agenda. He was much more worried about a social agenda than he was about a political agenda. But we have to remember that his biggest downfall, his Achilles heel, was trying to clip the military's wings, was trying to subjugate the military to civilian command. That's why the military said enough, and they used the protests, the 30 million people on the streets, to basically take power over, something that is unjust for any Egyptian. I don't think Egyptians would trade the Muslim Brotherhood for a military regime.
I can't say that. I wasn't there. I'm not so sure how you can be so certain of that.
I was literally talking to people on the ground. I've been studying Egypt for about 15 years now.
So again, but if what you're saying is that the public rose up in support of the military, though.
The public rose up not in support of the military.
That is unique.
The public stood up against Morsi, We have to distinguish between what the public wanted versus what the public didn't want. The public may not have wanted Morsi anymore after one year of governance.
But the point is,
they did not support a fascist regime.
No. Of course, they didn't do that. But they, at that particular moment, they had to choose between the devil they knew, Morsi, and the entity which they believed was going to protect them.
You're right. And don't get me wrong. I mean, the Egyptian military is beloved by the Egyptian people. Until recently, it's beloved. It's one of the most trusted Egyptian institutions. But when they start killing civilians, that's when the military becomes this hated element of Egyptian society. Well,
okay, who pushed the issue of the killings? I mean,
who pushed the issue of the killings? What do you mean? What does that mean?
You talked about fascist regimes. What about who was it that killed Anwar Sadat?
The Muslim Brotherhood.
Exactly.
Yeah, so?
We know all about fascist regimes, and they exist in groups as well as governments.
But the Muslim Brotherhood wasn't killing people in the streets. It wasn't.
I disagree from what I've seen.
That's because they didn't have the army. They didn't have the armament to do it.
That's right.
But again, you would also acknowledge that in world history, there are provocateurs. There are those that want to provoke the military or the police, so the military and police overreact.
Of course there are, but that's where it's up to the military to be prudent and not to take the civilian role in society of governing society. Military should never govern society. We know that of all people in the United States of America.
One thing we know, this subject will not be resolved by next Sunday night. Craig Capstein, thanks very much for being with us. Khalil Morar, thanks very much for being with us. Jim Gehrig, thank you very much for being with us for this hour. And starring in hour number one along with Mark Levin. This program is a Gen V production produced in association with WLS Talk Radio. Thanks to Dan Dorfman and Tom Veracruz and Rita Veracruz for their assistance in the production of tonight's program. Until next week at the same time, this is Bruce Dubon. Good night from Chicago.